Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
And it dawned on me that if I went to school for architecture and then dropped out, I would be an architecture school dropout. But if I went to learn to cook and dropped out of that and then became an architect, it would be seen as some sort of success. So I decided to go to cooking school first.
That's so great.
This week, our guest is the acclaimed Parisian chef Daniel Rose, who has recently opened his first U.S. restaurant in New York, Le Coucou. The man bites dog of Daniel's story is that he became the darling of Parisian restaurant-goers and American tourists with his first restaurant, Spring, as, to quote George Gershwin, an American in Paris. That's right, Daniel made his huge splash in Paris as a young American chef. How did he get there and then here? Here to tell us is Daniel Rose. Welcome, Daniel, or should I say bonjour, chef, to Special Sauce.
Thank you for having me.
Oh,
I think anything special and anything with sauce I like.
So. That's good. You've come to the right place. First, let's talk about you grew up in Wilmette, Illinois. Let's talk about life at the Rose family table.
Oh, the Rose family table. Well, it was every day. It wasn't an organized breakfast. It was definitely an organized dinner. And all together, which apparently today they tell me is very rare.
Yes.
But I think at this time, this was fairly common, at least in our neighborhood. As soon as my dad came home from work, around 5:30, 6 o'clock, we all sat down together, the five of us. We ate in the kitchen, which is—
You ate in the kitchen.
We ate in the kitchen, but it was a beautiful kitchen that was very long and had a big Vulcan stove in it. That was kind of rare at the time. Nobody had restaurant stoves
in their house. So somebody was serious about food.
Yeah. My parents were serious about food. My mother was serious about cooking because she was serious about her family. So,
And so what did she cook? Like what was her—
Well, this was 1980, 85, probably, you know, until 1990. But that was when I became a teenager and almost became a teenager and started eating whatever the heck I wanted. But until that time— my mother was always kind of ahead of her time. We used to have nigiri sushi in our lunch boxes in 1983 or 84. Yeah, it was very strange. So we had
that is way out of its time.
Fried tofu pockets stuffed with sweet and sticky rice. Nobody had ever seen that before.
How did she know about this?
That's a good question. We have to ask her. But she was making tandoori chicken long before it was a thing.
Not in a tandoori oven, but using
tandoori
spices.
Yeah, exactly. Marinating it in yogurt and then using the
tandoori. Wow, that's totally insane. And all—
I didn't know it was special. We just, I mean, we knew it was good, but we didn't have any other reference. Although when we would go to other people's house for dinner, I think we realized that we had
You saw the disparity in quality?
Yeah, we never, you know, we weren't judging, of course, but— I think we were spoiled without really knowing it. It wasn't luxury. It was just – I mean now you'd think – actually now you'd consider it a kind of luxury. But at the time it was just very wholesome, interesting, well-cooked and different because I don't think there was ever leftovers, very rarely. So there was tandoori chicken on Tuesday and something else on Wednesday and every like maybe twice a year she would come home with live lobsters. That was a big thing and we'd watch them crawl across the floor and then eat them.
And this was all because of her own curiosity and interest in food?
You know what? I've never asked this question of my mom. I think – I mean she came from a – her grandmother was a wonderful cook. My grandmother was a good cook but her repertoire was
– Limited.
Limited, yeah. It was hamburgers, mashed potatoes, and peas for us, which was actually the perfect food combination. But her grandmother apparently was like – had a very large repertoire and was and cooked an awful lot. So I think it's just –
It's just passed down.
It's just, yeah, Jewish mom family cooking in some
Yeah,
ways.
But not too many Jewish moms.
Well, I guess so, yeah.
You know, put tofu pockets in their lunch – kids' lunch boxes.
Well, it was a Reconstructionist dinner as opposed to a reformer or conservative. But I guess on my dad's side, they were from New York. My father's mother was a notoriously awful cook. And I think the first time my dad ate green beans that were fresh, it was because of my mother. He had thought that they just always came from a can.
Right, which was, by the way, the standard practice in kitchens back then.
This wasn't too out of the ordinary, but there's a lot of distance between that experience and the way they eat now.
Did she get you involved in cooking, or did you gravitate towards, wow, I'd really like to know how she does that? Like, what was your relationship to this very, very forward-thinking food that you were being served?
It was very much ethereal in some ways, though we weren't really involved in the process, and we didn't watch, like, I don't have a memory of my mother slaving away in the kitchen for hours and hours, except maybe at holidays or something like that. But I don't think she did. I think she did it in a way that was smart, so that she didn't have to spend. She could make these nice things. I mean, it doesn't take hours and hours and hours to make nigiri sushi, but the result is delicious. So there was a kind of an interesting, and maybe I inherited it in some ways. Like, it wasn't about the marathon cooking sessions. It was about being clever and coming up with something that was delicious. And food is more delicious when it doesn't take all day to make, at least from my perspective. Some things do take that long, but if it can be done in 15 seconds or 20 seconds, it's much more delicious than if it takes 3 hours.
You're all for the 20-second preparation.
As long as we're not cheating. We're not talking about putting in a microwave. We're not talking, you know, we're talking about actually making something.
And so you went to Nutrier East?
I did go to Nutrier East.
You know that my college girlfriend went to Nutrier East, but we are—
I'm sorry.
No. We're very good friends. And because I went to Grinnell in Iowa, so it was filled with kids from Nutria.
Sure. Nutria was a special place.
And then, so you went to high school armed with nigiri sushi in your lunchbox, except when you started probably eating hot lunch at high school.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Now I think back, I think, what did I do to myself?
Right. But that was like such a step down for you. For most people, it was like, wow, this is kind of cool. But for you, it was like, this is not as good as what I could get at home.
I think that actually there was a point at which I at the end of high school, I actually became a vegan. I ate nothing but brown rice and broccoli. It wasn't even about vegan. It was no wheat, meats, fat, sugar. I mean, it was like this extreme diet. I don't really remember exactly why I did it.
Because it was an adolescent thing to do.
Yeah, it was about discipline. It was about – I felt great. I was running a lot and all this kind of stuff. And it was part of the – it was just something I felt an instinct to do it. I didn't reject other food, but I definitely realized – I think it was then that I realized that the power of how food makes you feel more than just –
the food itself.
The food itself. Yeah.
Which is really a theme of what you've been able to do in your work life, I think.
Well, we're always concerned about how food makes you feel, and it acts on many different levels. I mean, it acts on obviously a nutritional level, but we've all eaten that dinner that we wait, you know, when we go to bed and wake up at 3 a.m. wishing maybe we had had just a little bit less. At the same time, you kind of can't stop yourself when it's happening, because you get carried away.
Yes, I'm overly familiar with that. So you graduated from high school, but at that point, you didn't think you were going to be in the food world, right?
I graduated from high school. I had no idea I was going to be in the food world. I didn't have any. It never dawned on me to have anything to do with food professionally. I still loved restaurants. I mean, even when I went to visit colleges and during high school, when I went to visit colleges, I went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I ended up going. But the first stop was this Cafe Pascual or something like that in downtown Santa
Fe.
And I went to breakfast there and then walked to the I missed the appointment with the person I was supposed to meet in because I was having lunch, and then walked from there all the way to St. John's College.
So I think that was a sign, dude.
Yeah. I went to Johns Hopkins. We ate crabs. My dad and I ate crabs in Baltimore. I think that was definitely on the agenda. So but I didn't think of it as I wanted to go learn. Mm-hmm. So I went to college. I didn't think about so much what I wanted to do afterwards.
And so you went – did you go to St. John's in New Mexico?
I did go to St. John's in New Mexico.
Which is a very small, intense liberal arts college.
Yeah. I learned on the first day of school, I started learning enough Greek to, well, not all in one day, but I started learning Greek so that I could do translations of, we started translating parts of the Odyssey, the Iliad, and parts of Euclidean geometry.
Oof.
Yeah, I mean, it was only as intense as you wanted to make it. It sure. sounds sort of heady, but it's really,
yeah.
I had three lexicons open next to my page, and it took me an hour to do one sentence. So I wasn't particularly, I was interested in it, but yeah. I wasn't.
You graduated from St. John's.
So I actually didn't graduate from St. John's. I woke up in the middle of the night, probably after a dinner where I ate too much, and decided that I needed some adventure. So I decided to go to finish my university in Paris. So I enrolled in the American University of Paris.
Again, not thinking you wanted to be a chef.
No, not at all. I mean, thinking about all the things that I would probably be exposed to in France. I had actually never been to Europe before. But I enrolled in the school and I thought this is going to be interesting. So I started – I finished my degree in philosophy and art history with the credits that I had earned at St. John's. And all the, and then that was in 1998. And I ate in restaurants all over Paris for really for 2 years. I had been given a modest budget to travel around Europe, but I never actually went anywhere except out to dinner. And I became, I would say addicted, but it wasn't food. It was about the restaurant. I mean, food was an important part of it.
The experience.
There was something about going to a restaurant that was very, very seductive, really.
Almost magical.
Totally magical, and a good restaurant especially has that magical. It's the moment, it's, you know, like summertime when you don't want when you go out and you don't, you know, you don't want the sun to come up because.
Yeah, you don't want the evening to end.
You don't want the evening to end. So for me, the easiest way to get to that kind of a moment is at the table. It doesn't have to be fancy. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But I was exposed to that in Paris where it's really an art form to cultivate that moment. And I think that it was there that I saw that it was something that I could actually learn to do. And then after I graduated, I thought maybe I would become an architect or I would go to cooking school. And it dawned on me that if I went to school for architecture and then dropped out, I would be an architecture school dropout. But if I went to learn to cook and dropped out of that and then became an architect, it would be seen as some sort of success. So I decided to go to cooking school first.
That's so great.
It really wasn't any more calculated than that. And I think I sort of thought, well, yeah, that was my thinking, whether it was...
I mean, it worked out.
It worked out fine. Yeah. It worked out very well, actually.
And so you went to cooking school, and then you started cooking at serious restaurants all over France and even Belgium, right?
Yeah, my first internship after the first year at cooking school was at Jean-Pierre Bruno in Brussels. I spent not very long there, but boy, did I learn a lot. And a lot of it was, I think mostly, I learned less about cooking and more about myself during that experience. Like a lot of young people, underestimated the level of training and experience required to do these things that look easy. Mm-hmm. So I thought they looked easy, so I thought they were easy. That was a little short-sighted. From the way I look back at it now, is they were not easy. They didn't even look easy, so I wasn't seeing very clearly. And there was, and it required dozens of years of experience to be able to do what they were able to do. I didn't appreciate that at first. Now I appreciate it, and now I see in some of my young cooks that same kind of.
But what's interesting is that you probably acknowledged and embraced the idea that patience would be required to really become a chef.
I knew that after that, those first few weeks, I knew that there was going to be an apprenticeship that could not be accelerated. You could have lots of varied experiences and very different experiences with really excellent people, but something about the amount of time that it naturally takes to do these things, I started to realize. And so I just, instead of trying to get it all done very, very fast, I just sort of tried to find a place where I was comfortable and learning, and I would just continue to do that. And that's basically what happened up until I opened the first spring, which was 6 years later.
And the first time, so you worked for Bocuse.
So I went to the Institut Bocuse in outside of Lyon, where I was indoctrinated into the world of French cooking through the school. And then they send you on a series of internships. The first one was raté, as we say in French. It wasn't a success. And then I thought that what I needed to do was go to a 3-star Michelin restaurant, and I probably did. And so that's what I did, and then realized that I needed something on a smaller scale, and I needed to start at the beginning. So it's very difficult. Like even for somebody, a customer, right? If you go to a 3-star Michelin restaurant, before you have eaten enough other stuff, you don't appreciate it as much. So I needed to go someplace where I could begin to create some kind of vocabulary for appreciating all these experiences. And so I went back to the school, and the director of the school sent me to a small restaurant in Brittany, which had, I don't know, 26 seats or something like that, and one chef who was a Meilleur Ouvrier de France, very highly regarded and decorated chef. And he worked there in the restaurant that his grandmother had started with a dishwasher who lived, an illiterate woman named Lucienne, who...
And that was the staff.
Yeah, and that was the staff. And it was me and this girl from Spain who was another intern. And there was, it was completely, and I lived in the garage or behind the restaurant, and there was one bathtub in the place. I mean, it sounds like a silly movie, but it was anything but silly, although it was very cinematic. And of course, it's in Brittany, so it rained for, I don't know, I want to say 9 months.
That's 40 days and 40 nights.
It rained a lot, but never actually rained. It just sort of like, it was like misty and like curtains of water for the entire winter. And I had a great time. The morning I would cook downstairs, which was like a restaurant for the workmen in town who were working on the streets or working. And it was like a 10 or 12 euro. Actually, this time there was no euro, so... It was just before the euro. I don't remember how much it was, but it was a couple bucks for lunch. And we would serve one thing every day, and I would cook it on this coal-fired
stove. And you just get a platter.
You would just get a platter. It was a first course, a main course, and dessert. I mean, this is, by American standards, it sounds very fancy. But that's how you really eat in France. And you could have cheese, you know, if you wanted.
But that's interesting because that's where you sort of embraced the whole concept of scale or lack thereof.
Yeah. It was just me. And I thought it was me, and the chef would come in and make sure like I had the chickens in the oven by the right time because I needed to be on time. And the stove was coal fired. So you had to start it up, and you couldn't every day at 2 o'clock when the last customers would come in, I would try to cook something and I would like stare at this pan that would take forever to heat up because the fire was sort of dwindling down. In the beginning, it was very frustrating, and in the end, it was almost comforting.
Sure, sure.
You live by a different clock. That was the clock of all the meal periods and stuff. And then Sundays we would go to mass. He would say, and it was really meant that we would the three or four of us working in the restaurant would go to the bar where you buy lotto tickets and bet on horses in this small little town, and we would drink white wine and then serve Sunday lunch. And then
that's my kind of mess.
Exactly, yeah, a la mess. It was great. It was like my kindergarten. You know, it was like the first steps of learning to be a professional, learning to be a student in some ways. It was incredibly privileged, even if it was uncomfortable and a little weird. But it was something that I would not give that one up for anything.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like in a way that was paramount in your mind when you finally opened Spring. It was like the most direct connection.
It is the most direct connection. He was the whole idea of the fixed menu, which was what Spring was about, was I learned from the chef, Jean-Luc Lour, because he wanted to become a Meilleur Ouvrier de France and he needed to train for it, and he couldn't spend all of his days cooking in the restaurant. So he made it more essential and just made a fixed menu.
Yeah.
And did fewer covers.
And he was okay with that.
And he loved it.
And you observed that he was okay with that.
He was okay because it had only started a few months before. And he had told me stories about how he threw all the pots out the window and was frustrated all the time. And he had found a solution for himself to both be accepted by the sort of very formal cooking world. He's this guy out in this restaurant all by himself who becomes a maître de France. It would be like some guy writing for the Wilmette Life who is suddenly—
all of a sudden wins a Pulitzer Prize at the New York Times.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And he trained hard for it, and he set it up so that he could do that. And he had found clever solutions in order to prioritize the things that were important to him. And I think in some ways that's what I learned as much as the food. At the same time, the food that we cooked there still resonates with me. One of the first things I was known for at Spring, an almond puree, was his recipe. I don't know where he got it from. And at the time I was making it, I don't even think I understood the importance of that recipe, but it was cauliflower and almonds, which in some ways it tastes delicious together.
But it's sort of counterintuitive.
Exactly.
It's like nutty on nutty.
It's nutty on nutty, but it's also geographically counterintuitive.
Yeah, yeah.
Almonds from the south, cauliflower from the north. That's where it was actually really interesting. And I think in some ways that recipe sums up a lot of what I learned from him.
Yeah.
I could enjoy the things we made as they were being made through the jests, through what I was actually learning to make. And then later, as I understood more about French cooking, I realized that there was actually a stroke of genius behind it.
Yeah.
That's interesting because these things are thick and you can experience them on a different level. You know, I can eat the most delicious barbecue in America. It may or may not have a history behind it, but if later I discover that it does have a history, it's even more delicious.
Yes.
And so the first degree is, of course, simple deliciousness. And then you can increase that deliciousness through some kind of
context.
Exactly, context.
Yeah. So, but then you went on from there to bigger, like Hotel Maurice and all that. But it sounds like that was really the seminal cooking experience.
It was
for
the
you.
Seminal life experience. I mean, he said, "You know anything about artichokes?" I said, "No," and then he would bring in cases of artichokes, and that's what he put on the menu. So it was like, I mean, talk about an education. It was perfect. And then he sent me to one of his friends in the south, in near Avignon, who had a different kind of restaurant, and it was a different kind of chef. But I had a lot to learn there, and so I did. And then I had an adventure in Guatemala.
Right, where you were a head chef, right?
I was the chef, yeah. I thought that I was 3 years into my apprenticeship. I was pretty ambitious, and I thought, okay, I want to see if
I can lead the team.
I can lead the team. That's exactly right. So I went to Guatemala, and I led the team. And that was as much about cooking also as it was about leading the team. There was, I don't know, 10 or 12 Guatemalans that spoke Spanish but also spoke Quiche, this Indian dialect.
Did you learn Quiche?
I learned a few of the dirty words, I think. you know, like any time you learn a language, I learned the most essential curse
I remember
words.
The first French word I learned was merde.
I learned the equivalent of that very quickly in Quiche. But what I did learn was that we created a language that was a common language that was about beauty. So they would make something, and then I would show them how I saw it and what I thought was important in there. And then we wouldn't try to understand it. We would just ask each other which one was more beautiful. And then we always kind of – there was very few times when we didn't agree.
That's
and it wasn't because I made it that it was beautiful. It was – our mission was the same. I didn't want them to make what I made. I wanted them to make something more beautiful.
Even though they were seeing it through their lens and you were seeing it through yours.
Yes, and we often arrived at the same destination, which confirmed some of the things I think I learned from the Greeks, which is that there are things that are non-negotiably –
Beautiful.
Or... it's not just a question of perspective, that there are things that are actually delicious and that they're undeniably delicious and that it's more a common – it's something that's shared between people.
Yeah. So as an American, there probably weren't that many Americans sort of doing what you were doing at the time.
No, and in fact – when I was at all the restaurants I went to, they loved to parade me around because it was a mark. It was a mark of excellence for them to have a young American guy who slept on their floor in their backyard or whatever. who was dedicated to learning with them, it sort of gave them value.
Right.
Well, they didn't money it like that, but they definitely, at every opportunity, wanted to show their friends that they were the restaurant in the region that had the American working for them.
And were you subjected to hazing as a result of being an American, or that went beyond the usual chef training hazing, or was it?
I think, you know, I ended up with chefs that were very serious and fun. I don't think...
Total luck of the draw.
Total luck of the draw. I don't think there wasn't a lot of hazing going on. I think I was also a little older. You know what? I probably at some points didn't even understand I was hazing.
Because you thought it was learning.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they sent me out to go find... I made enough funny mistakes that... that they probably got their laughs without even having to set anything up.
That's funny. So what were the – I mean, you've talked a lot about the lessons you learned in Brittany, but what were the most important overall life lessons you learned during your multi-year apprenticeship?
It's funny that there was an evening when I took Jean-Luc – when Jean-Luc Lure declared that he wanted to go out, it was a Sunday night, so we drove in his car down the coast to, like, the coast of Brittany. There was like a small casino or something, and so we went to this casino and he got too drunk to drive home. So I drove stick shift for the first time.
Interesting.
Which was a long ride back, but it was a beautiful night. There's no other cars out. There's a big beautiful moon. We gambled, and I mean, it was kind of like a wholesome, funny night out. And we got back to the town where his restaurant was, and his buddy owned the bakery across the street. It's in a town called Lannilis, and they have a wonderful little terrace where you can have coffee in the morning and croissants and things. The guy was a chef but became a baker, and we got back at about 5 in the morning when the first bread was coming out. And so we got the hot baguettes, and we were in his grandmother's auberge at the old bar downstairs, and we were opening the bread and it was steaming and we were putting butter on it. And I remember him starting to cry. I don't know if there were tears, but there was some sort of an emotional meltdown. And he started to explain to me that all he really wanted, that there was nothing better in the world that he could cook than this bread coming out of this oven right now, right there.
Wow.
Yeah, and then he started to tell me about how if I continued on this path, I would be alone, and that all the women I love would leave me.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was intense. And I think I was like, I don't know, I was 20-something, like early 20s. And you know, people give you advice and things. He wasn't even giving me advice. It turns out that he was very much, he said I would be very lonely. But at the same time, he was giving me hope that it didn't have to be that way.
You could turn out differently than he did.
Yes, exactly. And I think that was, I mean, it was all mixed up, right? There was food, there was love, there was, all of this like effort to try to make this great restaurant, and he knew that this bread we were eating there was better than anything he could possibly make.
Yeah,
there was a lot of moments like that,
and those were the lessons, much more than how to cook this fish or whatever.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I remember once he had this idea. He wanted to take partridge breasts and he sort of confit them in a little bit of almond oil and left them above the stove where they just sort of cooked very slowly. And I remember they were overcooked and stuff. And he said, oh, shit, they're overcooked. But we served them anyway. And people came back into the kitchen and said how wonderful it was. He was very, very lucid about the process and about the creative process and about what it was he was giving to people, really. What it really meant to screw something up or ruin somebody's dinner.
Right.
I mean, these guys are very, they have a lot of experience. He had worked for a lot of different people, and then he had gone through this process of winning this competition. These are mistakes at a very high level where we're way beyond whether or not it's got enough salt in it or
right.
It's like
sure.
Too much butter or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And so I think it sounds like you learn more in terms of point of view and attitude and philosophy about not just food but about figuring out a way to enjoy yourself while you're doing it.
He was, yeah, I mean, that he was goofy and wacky, and he used to, you know, put pots on his head and dance around, and he had a great sense of humor. And he also had a kind of a, there was a, not a dark side, but there was a, yeah, a tortured side maybe. Dark sounds like he was sort of evil. It was an evil in any way. Yeah. But there was definitely a tortured side.
Yeah, he was conflicted. He was conflicted. Like all of us.
Yeah, probably. So in that sense, it's a very, all of this was like a very human experience. Yeah. And I was able to do it in very beautiful places with very beautiful people, with material that interests me.
Right. That's a trifecta.
A trifecta, yeah. And very early.
But it's so interesting that if you didn't have that experience early, which I think has profoundly influenced your life, then your life might have turned out very differently.
I certainly would not have been able to go about all of these different experiences that came after that one without the worry associated with
it. Got it.
Sometimes you have to let – he told me too. He said, you know, you have to let it happen to you. It's very difficult to – put yourself in that position.
Mm-hmm.
When you're learning,
because you're not in control.
There are breakthroughs that happen, things that I experienced then that I only understood many years later.
Right.
And that's the kind of – that's the, and even now that happens. Being open to those things is as much an important part of the process as any other.
So give us a couple of examples of that.
I mean some of it had to do with the history of food. So what I thought was just him making stuff up actually had like a very profound, deep relationship to the history of French cooking, where he would take a traditional preparation and juxtapose it with something else. I mean, frequently like the almond and the cauliflower. These are two things that do not go together. This was a very Jacques Maximin moment, right? You have
Jacques Maximin was this famous chef in Nice, right?
In Nice, but he was from the north.
Right.
And so you had this kind of crazy mix of north and south that was at once delicious and at once very revolutionary.
Right. Confounding, like, in some ways.
Yeah. It made it more delicious, even for people that didn't know. That's a very magical thing.
And what about something like that that's happened since you've had your own restaurants?
I made so many screwed up dishes along the way because it's spring. It was literally a new thing every day.
Right.
So I would like break my head in order to try to figure out what to do new the next day.
Right. Yeah. You were living Bob Dylan's "There's no success like failure, and failure's no success at all."
That's
why he won the Nobel Prize.
I don't know how I didn't end up on drugs or drinking too much.
Because those two things were ever present.
Oh my God. I think like now, I mean, now the process is very different, but I thought that the highest level of being a cook was the perpetually creative process. So I would create and destroy every day, create and destroy every day. Sometimes in the middle of dinner I would do it. It was a necessary process. I did that for 3 years or more, three or four, almost 5 years, before I realized that it wasn't very good for my customer.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was.
Yeah, yeah.
But that actually if I could just relax a little and take the things that I thought were interesting and delicious and remake them again, that it was actually better for everyone, including myself. That took years for me to figure out.
Right.
And even now, I sometimes have to subdue the urge to want to mix it all up all the time.
Yeah, just and you and I talked about this at the restaurant, you know, that Monk line about it's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't play.
Yeah. How many times have I made something that just had too much stuff in it?
Yeah.
But there's a difference between what your experience as you're creating and then what the customer experiences.
Right.
It's very hard for the two to happen at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard to align the two.
Right.
It happens sometimes maybe with certain musicians who are able to bring people along in their improvisations and things like that. But generally, most of that audience wants to hear the...
Yes, the hits.
The hits.
Yep.
They don't want to hear the screwed up stuff.
Right.
There's a few people in the audience that do and who appreciate it.
Who appreciate the process.
Yeah. So trying to find that balance is important.
Yeah. So let's talk about your relationship to tradition. which is something we talked about when I was at the restaurant. But your food is very much a part or comes out of many aspects of French culinary tradition. And yet you sort of, in many ways, and not always, but kind of turn some of them on, you know, like 45 degrees. And was that intentional? Like, did that just happen?
These things just happen. I don't think that there was never, there's no concept in which one takes tradition. Well, there is, but it's very, usually very annoying, where you take something traditional and then slant it in a way for the sake of slanting it. This is a process. So we're trying to find out what's, look, if this is the same thing that happened to me when I wanted to be like a revolutionary in when I was in high school. I thought of myself as like, I think I was a communist for a day before, you know, I wanted to be a communist revolutionary, except that I didn't know anything about communism or democracy or anything. But I wanted to reject all the things that I inherited. And then one day when I was in the shower, I remember very clearly thinking, holy shit, if I reject all this stuff, I'm really, especially the things that you inherit intellectually, culturally, you're really saying that you come from a long line of idiots who understood nothing, which is possible to do,
right?
But puts you in a very precarious situation.
Yes, it leaves you vulnerable.
It leaves you vulnerable. And in fact, it genetically leaves you an idiot. So you have to be—
That's never a good place to be.
No. So I needed to figure out, I needed to get past that. And so I thought, okay, this is the tradition. All of my— whether it's, you know, actually my grandfather, my great-grandfather, or my grandmother, whatever, or the people that taught me how to cook and the people that showed me how to do this, they believed this.
Mm-hmm.
So either they understood something that I didn't or they were idiots.
Right.
I think that it's probably wiser to try to figure out what it was that was important about what they understood than to simply declare them idiots.
And that's your relationship
that's
to
my
tradition.
To tradition, absolutely. So I haven't gotten through 30% of it.
Wow.
And the slants are, in terms of the actual food, is really just about the— it's part of an exploration. It's not— I'm not trying to imagine what people might find interesting. That's one way in which you can bring people along the process without making them feel like they're part of your experiment or that you're in anything other than a restaurant,
right?
Which is much more interesting than someone's experiment.
Sure.
At least from my perspective, mm-hmm. Because that's a party. Yeah. I want to go to a party. I don't want to go to somebody's thesis. I want to go to somebody's
yes.
party.
Yeah, somebody reading their PhD thesis would really be boring.
Yeah. And you don't— – and at the same time, it doesn't mean that you can't fill it with substance and good content
yeah.
either. But that's not what makes it good necessarily.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing I thought about when I was eating your food is there's a sort of life-affirming, joyous quality to it. Is that something you're conscious of, or is that something that just happens?
No, that is a conscious choice. All things should be an affirmation of life. Why would you want to do something that wasn't?
I know, but a lot of people do. I'm with you, but it doesn't seem like—
It doesn't mean you succeed every time.
Yes, it doesn't mean you succeed every time. And also, the culture does— that's not what people learn in school.
This is where things get a little thick. One of the things I learned early on before I started cooking was that in order to enjoy life, you need to embrace its limited nature. And so just in that moment alone, you have no other option but to be joyful.
Right.
For me. There's nothing mm-hmm. else to do. I mean, the only way you can enjoy life is to dispel your fear of death in some ways. And so the only way for me that I know how to do that is through joy. In fact, the joy I find is in that very act of saying, like, not only could this be— – is this a party, but this could be your last party. Sounds sad, but
right.
actually in there
right.
is a tremendous liberty.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
yeah.
a weight that frees you.
It's not really a last supper. It's something else entirely.
Even the worst dinner. I've had dinners with my wife that are not good. It does not prevent us from having a good time.
Yes.
Because it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because we are having the moment together. And while we are saying, good God, we don't understand what this guy is doing or this girl is doing or what they're doing in the kitchen or how did they screw this
right.
up.
Right. It was still, a magical evening.
It's still some kind of affirmation of.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That. Rarely is it so bad that it right. depresses
right.
you.
Right. So I want to talk a little bit about spring because on the face of it, so you're a young American chef. You come back to Paris. You decide you're going to open up a neighborhood restaurant where you cook something different every day in 16 seats. So first of all, why did you not think that was a suicide mission? Because 16 seats is really hard to make a go of it. I well, guess you learned from Brittany that you didn't need a lot of staff.
I didn't. Yeah, it was not a suicide mission at all. I had a very carefully planned business plan, which was that if I had 10 people a day and they each paid $60 per person, that I would be okay.
Then you'd be okay. You wouldn't get rich, but you'd be okay.
I never never said I won't get rich. I didn't even – that wasn't even on the
– in the consideration set.
No, it was just I make more than I make at the Hotel Maurice cooking for Yannick Aleno in underground. And here I get to do – I mean the rent was $692 a month. The loan payments were about $1,100. And I was the only employee. How could I go wrong? On paper, the thing was a tremendous success. It made a huge profit compared to all the restaurants since, percentage-wise.
Right.
Of course, we're not talking about large sums
right.
of money. We're talking about $40,000.
Yeah, exactly. It's subsistence farming, only it's subsistence restaurant.
And it was nourishing way more than my bank account or my reputation, which was growing. But I didn't even think of that. I mean, I didn't think I was making an investment in that. It was an education. And I was cultivating this. I was enjoying myself and I was profoundly in touch with that.
With the joy we just talked
about. With the joy we just talked about. It was tremendously joyful. It was tortured at times.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, it was tremendously, tremendously joyful. It still is, basically. I mean, the chant at Spring is joyeux, joli, généreux. Joyful, generous, and pretty. That's the even at the Cuckoo, they've learned to sing that song.
And that's your aesthetic.
That is my aesthetic, yeah. It's a kind of a devise, you know? I mean, it's like it's a kind of a motto, but it certainly covers the basis for anything. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't have to be exactly how I want it.
Right.
As long as is this joyful? Yeah. And labeling something as joyful is... It's not as simple as it sounds.
No.
Because it can be, at the same time, it gives you lots of liberty in there because it cannot be perfect also and be
yes.
very joyful.
Yes, and you got to clear away a lot of brush.
Yeah. And generous is also, it gives you a lot of latitude. Also, it's not just about big. That goes deep into quality and resources and comfort and all sorts of different things. And pretty, too, is like negotiable.
Right.
Although...
But the Guatemalans knew when it was pretty.
Oh, my God. Did they know when it was pretty? They were wonderful. They were joyful, too. And I think that's something I learned from them. They had a shit life. It was hard as – they had to – you know, some guy had to ride his bicycle uphill, you know, for 40 miles to come to work every day.
Right.
I slept in the hotel.
Right.
I had very comfortable. I didn't
right. –
I had to wander out of bed. And these guys would come to work with a smile on their face. That's impossible to ignore. Impossible.
We do want to get to the buffet. There's a zillion other things I want to talk to you about. But one of the things that we talked about at the restaurant was the pressures associated with chef-driven small restaurants, the financial pressures. And we read a lot about that in New York and how hard it is to do in New York. And I remember talking to you at the restaurant. And you said it's really not that much easier in Paris. But you continue to do so. You've got three you're about to have. Is your third restaurant?
It's just opened on Wednesday, yeah.
So you've got three restaurants in Paris. None of them are very big, right?
No, they're small.
Yeah.
But they do allow excellent people to do excellent work at them
mm-hmm.
And explore different ideas and to perpetuate this.
And to you, that's the greatest kind of wealth to create.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I do have to, you know, clothe myself, although it's not very complicated because I wear the same thing every day.
Yeah, you know, wait, I'm looking at your clothes, man. You don't spend a lot of money on those clothes.
I don't know. I don't. But no. And I don't drink. I mean, I don't know. it depends really on what your ambition is. Like, mm-hmm. These restaurants weren't started to they're profitable, and there's an important economy going on. But this is not about empire building. This is about having ideas. And one of the things that needs to be taken into consideration when you put an idea into action is the economy of it.
Right.
It needs to pay for itself. And in fact, I find the process of making things financially autonomous part of the creative process also.
Yeah.
And then it's that sort of thing that my mother told me, you know, is like, you do what you think is interesting and do it sincerely, and then you'll find a way to make money. These restaurants are small, but if they were big, they would just be that much more complicated, but they would also generate
more.
But in Paris, the market is smaller and there's not as many people, and people, you know, the way in which people spend their money is different. It's interesting because the investment structures in New York are very different. So people, you know, in Paris we take a loan from the bank who lends us money at like an incredibly low
interest rate.
I think the current restaurant has a loan at 1.6%.
Wow.
I mean, that's like...
Can't do that here.
No. People want their 20% back or whatever.
And you have to give them your kids as collateral.
Something like that. And that's fine, too, because that pressure creates certain efficiencies and excellent ideas as well.
Yeah.
So it's just very different. But it's for me, it's fascinating. And I'm lucky because I can participate in both worlds.
Yeah. So you opened in New York. You partnered with a restaurateur. It's in a hotel. So it's a very different experience than your own experiences in Paris. And so talk a little bit about what you're trying to do with Le Coucou and how it came about.
I don't know that I always wanted to open a restaurant in New York City. This was an opportunity to work with somebody who has who's known for a very different style than I am, Stephen Starr.
Right, very much a business-driven, hard-driving restaurateur.
Yeah, but with a similar, I would say a similar folie that you might find in, say, Jean-Luc Lure. In fact, now that I think about it, there's something that there's
folie,
a little bit of madness.
Got it.
That might be too strong as a translation, but a little bit of madness and an extreme sensitivity also,
mm-hmm.
sensitivity. It's not all about business.
Right.
He is deeply attached to the creative process.
Oh, yes. I've spent many hours with him talking about this. He loves the creative process is much more important about than the deal making.
Yeah. And so for me, in some ways, I understand that because that's what I'm doing and that's what I'm doing as well. And so there's a kind of a complicity that's created. And that was created before we started thinking about a restaurant.
Got it. Just
and that
out.
Complicity I thought was very important. There was enough – he's brave enough to have given me these resources to create this restaurant. He left some things to my own imagination. And I didn't have to share them with him until the restaurant was actually open.
Yeah.
And he understands that's part of the creative process, which is sort of fascinating.
Were you prepared for the sort of white hot reception that the restaurant got, where it was like it automatically has become the hottest, most difficult reservation to get? Like, and I know that's not how you think. Like, how did you deal with that? Or you just tried to ignore it?
I don't ignore it because it does, you know, there are people have expectations that are coming to the restaurant. So you can't, ignoring it would be at my own peril. I mean, I'm aware of it. It doesn't, again, it's a bit like you have your process and then the public participates in that process in a different way. For them, it's all success. And for me, it's just a lot. There's still so much more work to do. No, I wasn't ready for white hot success. I mean, I remember the few days before we opened, I was worried nobody was going to come. I wasn't so worried because I thought, well,
Steve knows what he's doing.
Well, he has an instinct, yeah. But there's always that. There's always that. Every time you, a guy who has 35, 40 restaurants, there's got to be one in there that goes belly up like
outlier
in a week, right?
Right.
And so I thought, well, this could be the one, right? Like as the more successful restaurants you create, the closer you get to having one that goes kaboom.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't obviously didn't stop for too long to think about that, but. Yeah, I didn't stop to worry because worrying doesn't really – if there's something that can be fixed, then you need to do it.
and worrying is getting in the way of that action. And if there's nothing to do to fix it, then worrying is also not really particularly useful.
Sure.
So we just do.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that it has had such a reception. I knew that there were pieces of it that would, I was hoping that that would resonate with people. In some ways, I'm very pleased that some of the things that I thought would resonate actually do.
Yeah. And you're doing your food, really. You haven't really said, okay, I'm going to come to America and I'm going to do American food.
No. In fact, I think for me, this is another expression of my understanding of the food world. It's not a French concept. All I know how to do is cook French food. So that's what I make. And of course, we adapt it to...
Sure, the ingredients you can get. And...
Absolutely. And we create a process and we're trying to train cooks and we're trying to make a beautiful restaurant. It's not like I woke up one day and was like, you know what New York City needs is... The moment you say New York City needs, you're dead. You're dead. You think you know what this city needs?
Exactly.
This city needs nothing. They have everything, and they've all tasted everything. And
yep.
They, so
yep.
We just try to – that's where the joy comes in.
Yep.
So you think, well, yeah, they need
they
what
need
everyone
joy.
Needs.
Exactly.
Is joy.
Yeah.
And we can get there through some of these dishes, and
sure.
We'll screw some up. It'll be okay.
I certainly was overjoyed to be at the restaurant twice. So now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. You don't have to worry. We don't have a clock. There's just some questions that we like to ask everybody. So who's at your Last Supper? No family allowed. It could be living or dead. It could be philosophers, novelists, just like someone you think – a group of people that you think it would be fun to cook for and eat with.
Winston Churchill.
Okay.
Just because I think – no matter what he says, it sounds like it's very important. And
it's true.
Kind of heavy. and it seems like that kind of grumpiness, which is really a facade for a joy about life,
mm-hmm.
Which I think I would find interesting.
All right.
Plotinus.
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 Who's Plotinus?
Plotinus wrote On the Nature of Things. I think that was the first... time I realized that you needed to dispel your fear of death in order to live properly.
Got it. Okay.
And I think that sounds like the perfect dinner companion.
All right. Keep going. You got two more.
Artists,
musicians, novelists.
Nina Simone would be there.
Ooh. Nina Simone is awesome.
Yeah.
Did you see the documentary?
I did.
It's so powerful.
Yeah. It's that same sort of collision between life and death.
Yeah.
That
oh
is,
my God.
An affirmation of life in the
sure,
end.
Sure, sure.
And that's the kind of thing that
that's
I think
great.
Is.
Nina Simone, Winston Churchill, there's one more.
Plotinus. Fernand Poing, the great French chef.
One of the fathers of
modern French
cooking.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think he died in 1955. But, you know, there's this mythology about him that he used to eat two chickens every morning and drink Chateau Grier from the bottle or what, I don't even, I mean, whatever.
Right.
That's probably, there's something like that.
So he'd probably be fun to hang out with.
I think there's a kind of a big chef with the kind of a...
Sounds like he was like almost a Falstaffian figure.
Totally.
And what are you eating at your Last Supper with this really totally fascinating group of people, I might add?
We'd have to be in France.
Okay.
And we probably have to be, maybe not in Paris, maybe outside in the countryside somewhere.
Okay.
And it would be the fall.
Okay.
There needs to be seps and game birds and lots of burgundy.
Okay. Side dishes and dessert?
Riolet à l'impératrice. Rice pudding. The empress's rice pudding.
Okay.
Just because it's one of those elusive things that when I see the pictures or people make it, it just doesn't sound very good. But one of these great chefs made it. And he was famous for it, so it couldn't be the one I've seen pictures of.
Got
it has to be delicious.
Got it. All right. What do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat for your family?
Seamless. When there's nothing.
No.
Just like everyone
besides
else.
Besides seamless.
Oh,
in Paris.
My best recipe. Oh, in Paris. Wow.
Yeah.
Paris, we're very lucky. I mean, I live down the street from one of the best purveyors of meat, fish, and vegetables.
So there'll always be something in your fridge that you can cook.
There's always a chicken in the fridge. There's always a boudin noir in the fridge. There's always a can of boudin noir in the cupboard. There's always potatoes.
Man,
there's always
I want to come to your house for like a quickie dinner, man.
It's very easy to cook in France because the food has a lot of taste. So a few Brussels sprouts left over in the bottom of the bin still taste good.
Yeah.
And a little duck fat and...
You're good.
And potatoes, delicious. Yeah.
Yeah.
A little splash of vinegar. I mean, that's yum. Yum.
So who would you love to have a one-on-one lunch with? Any person living or dead, just because... Either they have a lot of explaining to do, or you just think that what comes out of their mouth will be unexpected and smart and joyful.
There are a lot of people that probably could fit on that list. And in a weird way, I think that it would be Kim Jong-un.
This is the North Korean?
Yeah, the North Korean.
Okay, now you've totally stumped me.
Yeah. And it has less to do with about thinking that he might say something joyful, but precisely that. The question is we don't know nothing about this person except what we see on the
news and stuff. Where he seems to represent evil.
Yes, exactly. And the question for me that I would really want to answer is how much of this – is this true or is this completely – or is there any humanity left in this person at all? Because we are led to believe that there is none.
Right.
And that – and also, like, eating at the table, like, is a very intimate moment. So
sure.
You'll see right away whether this is – whether there's something real going on there or whether this is a complete fabrication.
Yeah.
There are moments in the world where you wonder whether or not you know anything at all, especially today, right, where we get information in our telephones all the time. I don't – I'm not paranoid about whether it's true or not. We know that – it's a little bit true probably, but it's very hard today to understand how much of things are
right. So
real
you think that sitting across the table from Kim Jong-il could yield some unexpected observations?
We might learn something about him, but I actually don't care so much about him. But I might – maybe I would afterwards. But
right.
It might help to either reassure me or not about – what it is we think we know about the world.
Yeah.
I could be terribly surprised.
Yeah. That's great.
So I think, use him as an example, but somebody like that.
Yeah. Well, this has been spectacular.
And maybe if with a little luck, he'll be listening, because I'm sure
he's a special
he's not as
listener.
Cut off as we, exactly. as we think.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Daniel Rose.
Thank you.
If you're lucky enough to be in Paris, visit Spring, La Bourse et la Vie, and now Chez la Vie
at the old lady's place.
Right. But just don't hit me up for reservations because I can't help.
Neither can I, unfortunately.
And by the way, is there a secret to getting a reservation?
I think the first secret is to let somebody know you want one.
Got
Sometimes
it.
When people think that you can't get a reservation, you don't reach out because
right.
you say, oh, you can't get one.
Got it.
Call the restaurant. Send a message. They are there to help you get what you want.
Yeah.
Not simply to tell you no. So
got it.
They'll do their best.
And if you're in New York, of course, eat at Le Coucou, which is quite spectacular. Make sure you have the rabbit. We'll see you next time, Serious Eaters. And thank you again, Daniel Rose. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.